The Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Today is July 27th, 2005. We will be speaking with Loretta Freiling, the Administrative Assistant for the Institute of Research in the Humanities. She has been with the Institute from its inception in 1959. We are going to begin the interview with some questions to Loretta about herself, her background, her entry into the University of Wisconsin, and how she came to be associated with the Institute. So to begin, Loretta, tell us where you were born and a little bit about your education and background.
I was born in Fenimore, Wisconsin. My father was Czech. He came from Prague when he was only 2 years old. And his parents lived with us, and they never learned English. So my first language was Czech. And I had a very old world type upbringing, which I think gave me my interest in the Mideast and Egypt, especially in Greece. So gravitating towards this was just a blessing as far as I can see.
Now, did you grow up in the Fenimore public schools?
Yes. But then after graduating from high school, I had great admiration for my older sister. She came to Madison, went to business college, and I just followed suit with her.
Uh-huh.
And so did I. My first job actually was with the motor vehicle department in the safety responsibility section, where people, if you have too many parking violations, you can have your license taken away, but then you can appeal. So actually I did court reporting, but the old fashioned way, by hand rather than these little machines. So I'm still pretty good with shorthand.
Now that's interesting. Can you give us a year for that, when you were working as a court reporter?
Oh, 48, 49,
uh-huh.
In that period. And then after I was married and had two children, I wanted to go back to work, but I wanted a part-time job. I didn't want to work full-time. And the only one open was at the university in the History of Science department. So one cold January, I trudged up Bascom Hill, and I walked in, and there sat Marshall Claggett. I said, "I'm applying for your part-time job." He said, "God knows we need you." That was that.
Now, Loretta, tell us, for posterity's sake, who Marshall Claggett was.
He was a professor of history of science, chairman of the department, and he was the one who founded the Institute.
And when you first met him, what year would that be?
52, I believe. 52.
Okay.
So I really was in the ground floor. He was preparing all of the material for the Institute, and I was typing up all of this, ready for him to hop down the hall to present to the president.
Now, Loretta, the Institute wasn't founded till 1959.
That's when we started, yes.
So what were you doing for Professor Claggett between 1952 and 1959?
I was department secretary in History of Science.
Okay.
And did all of his manuscripts for him, which was rather complicated. He did manuscripts of Archimedes, where I had to do the English and then match it up with the Latin. It was the Latin, then the English translation and the variant readings. I never actually studied language, I mean Latin, but being a Roman Catholic, I had plenty of Latin, and it was sort of studied myself, just absorbed it.
Loretta, you said your parents came from Czechoslovakia.
My father did.
Your father did. Was your home growing up, was there a premium placed on education? Were you pretty well read through high school?
Well, I remember my father reading until late at night. It was simply, you went to school, period. It was just expected of you.
But you must have had a wide range of interest to have been so interested in Professor Claggett.
Well, I wasn't particularly. He just happened on the scene. It was quite a wonderful accident that I walked in that day. And then when he started the Institute, And I had been in history of science that long. I said, gee, I really like it. I'd rather not go. And he said, look, I trained you all these years for nothing. I'm not going to leave you behind. He said, you get to meet the greatest scholars of the world. Now, come on. So I did.
Now, Loretta, talk to me a little bit about the genesis of Professor Claggett's thought or rationale for starting the Institute. What did he say to you? Was he talking about it from the beginning of when you knew him?
Pretty much. But you see, the History of Science office was right at the front door of Bascom Hall. And that was when all of the departments were in Bascom Hall. And he was such a charismatic fellow. All these people would be on their way to the office, but stop and talk to him. And how many times I would hear him say, we've got to have a Humanities Research Institute. And of course, he formed a committee. Many of these people, there was right upstairs was English, philosophy, history down the hall, comp lit, art history. They were all in the building. Mm-hmm. So it was an easy way to expand on his ideas and build up the support of his colleagues.
Now, I noticed in your material there are several references to an advanced institute at Princeton.
That's the Institute for Advanced Studies.
And was that influential on Professor Claggett?
Yes, yes.
And how so?
He wanted it to be similar to that, but ours is strictly with humanities, and I think the Princeton Institute has various areas that they... Now, I don't know for sure, but I think they have things like economics and strictly mathematics.
Okay.
But he limited his to one area, the humanities.
Uh-huh. And what was, in history of science, what was his particular interest? You mentioned Archimedes.
That was it. I could show you the many volumes of Archimedes. There's about four of them, very big volumes. I remember his colleague, Erwin Hebert, saying, you know, I think one volume on Archimedes would be plenty. But of course, teaching in history of science, he had to have a very wide range of knowledge.
When, from what I read, it looked like that he, Professor Claggett, headed the drive to create the Institute.
Absolutely.
And had a committee.
Yes.
That prepared the proposal.
He prepared the proposal, but they would okay it.
I see. Who was particularly helpful to him on that committee?
I'm not sure who that would be. I know Madeline Doran, he used to say, she always does her homework. She would come well prepared for a meeting.
And she's a professor of English.
She was a professor of English, but she's since dead. And she was one of the senior members here for a long time.
Yes, I saw there's a fellowship in her name.
We now have a fellowship in her name.
Uh-huh.
This is, in fact, the first year it's going to be. She gave us the money, and we would use it for various miscellaneous things, which really wasn't her intent, I don't think. So when she also gave some money to the English department. So David Sorkin decided, let's pool the money, and we would have enough to have a one-semester fellowship for a graduate student every year, I believe we can.
Now, David Sorkin...
He's our director.
He's the current director.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Once Professor Claggett and his committee had prepared the proposal, to whom did they take it?
To E.B. Fred, the president. I don't know if he had assistants or what. Once it left the History of Science department, I don't know what happened to it down the hall. Even the president's office was right down the hall.
So there really was everyone.
Everyone. The graduate school next door to him.
Now, once the proposal went to President Fred, did he have to take it to the Board of Regents?
No, I don't think so. I think with the dean, if he approved it and the dean said, okay, we'll fund it, and that was that.
And did President Fred make the decision to place the Institute in Letters and Science?
It's the only place it could be.
Okay.
I mean, a humanities institute, and the professors involved were all letters and science.
So it was automatic? That
automatic,
was,
yeah.
And who was dean of letters and science then?
Mark Ingram.
Uh-huh. And were he and Professor Claggett friends?
Sure, yes. Oh.
And what was Professor Ingram's area?
I'm not sure, but I think it was in the sciences, mathematics, but that's a guess. Well, I'd have to really look it up.
Okay. Now, Loretta, I want to go through all of the directors of the Institute with you, because they seem to be so influential in directing how the Institute
yeah.
grew. And let's start with Professor Claggett. You've described him as charismatic and quite a scholar. What were some of the key things he did in the early years to really create a presence for the Institute?
Well, he was the one responsible for us to get the Herbert Johnson money for the Johnson Professorship, which was funded for quite a number of years. And also, we had the Johnson Postdoctoral Fellowship as well.
This is from the S.C. Johnson
yeah,
Company
at
in Racine.
Racine. Yes. And we even had a symposium on Mycenaean studies at Racine, and they gave us the funding for that, and we do have a volume.
How was Professor Claggett able, how did he know to go to the Johnson Foundation? Did he know the Johnson family?
No, he didn't know the Johnson family. It was just that I believe he knew they funded certain programs, and they liked the sound of this. I think they liked the idea of being involved in scholarship, and they did it for several years. But then they stopped. They said there were other things they wanted to concentrate on.
I see. But the Johnson money continued for 9 years?
About that, yes.
Okay.
A long time.
And when the Institute was created, did you move immediately into Washburn Observatory?
Yes.
Now, how did that happen?
The astronomers had moved out. And I remember Marshall had been on leave at the Institute of Princeton this year before. Well, he got back in the summertime, and he came running to my house. He was all excited. He said, "We've got the observatory. They told us we should, and otherwise we could have had some rooms in a house down here on Johnson Street. But this way we had our own building." And it truly gave us presence.
Uh-huh.
This was the Institute.
Now, when in the first few years of the Institute, Loretta, what were the range of your responsibilities here?
There wasn't much administrating to do, I mean, payrolls and that sort of thing, but typing manuscripts. I worked so hard. We have these prolific scholars. You have Marshall Claggett and Germain Bray and Friedrich Sompson, and they're almost vying for my time. I really worked so hard. But then, with the advent of the computer, people started doing their own, and we have all of these fellowships now, and that takes a lot of administering for the fellowships.
So would you say for the first decade, or certainly
yeah.
well into the 60s, you were primarily producing on your typewriter manuscripts for the scholars
yes.
here?
Then we also had this little thing called Nestor that Emmett Bennett published works in Mycenaean studies, and then I spent two or three days a month getting that thing ready to go.
And Nestor being, spell that for me.
N-E-S-T-O-R.
And was that a journal?
Well, it was typewritten sheets. I guess you'd call it a journal, but it wasn't in volumes. And there was a lot of classicists around the world got it. Kept them up to date on what research was being done in the area.
On Professor Claggett, was he instrumental in recruiting some of the scholars that you got here in the early years?
Absolutely. But he was also open to suggestions from other people, from his colleagues. Recommendations?
How were the scholars selected, Loretta?
We've always had a selection committee.
And how does that work?
Well, today we have the dean from letters, a dean from the Letters and Science, one from the Graduate School, one from the Humanistic Foundation, the Humanities, and four of our own faculty, plus the director, and then one of our senior people.
Uh-huh.
And of course I have to get applications to everyone, and they read them, and they make the decisions. And
now, was the Institute attractive to humanities scholars from the very beginning?
I think so.
Here?
Yeah.
And
anytime you can have leave from teaching to concentrate on your research is a boon. And Marshall Claggett felt very strongly about postdoctoral fellowships for young scholars. He said, they're just in the field, they have heavy teaching loads, and they have to publish in order to have promotions, and they need their year's leave.
Uh-huh.
He was very understanding and sympathetic about that.
Now, while Professor Claggett ran the Institute, was he also teaching, or was
he? Oh, yes. Graduate courses then,
uh-huh.
Not the undergraduate. But our not our outside visitors, but our visitors have always, or not those who are strictly research lead, but our senior members have always had to teach a course.
What did you like best about working for Professor Claggett?
He was just one awfully nice man. Very interesting work.
Uh-huh. Do you remember from the early years when you had to produce the manuscripts, were there some that really caught your fancy?
Germaine Bray's. I mean, she's in 20th century French literature. I mean, I just went on and read about that. And when I took French, I suggested we read Camus' L'Étranger, and the instructor said that was fine, because I knew it was an easy book to read. And we read that, and I studied French because it was easier to work with her. I studied modern Greek because now I could type Greek for Solmsen's work. And then I got requested from a variety of places on campus. I knew how to type Greek and had a Greek typewriter, which is all right.
I
studied German too, but I'm not very good in German.
Have you maintained some fluency in French and Greek and Latin? German?
Not German, but French and Greek. Of course, I go to Greece a lot, so that helps too.
Now, I saw where Professor Claggett left in 1965. Was he recruited by Princeton?
He was offered a research position in the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. And he always said, if I'm ever offered a job there, I'm going. A couple of years before that, he was offered a job at Harvard. Oh, and his colleagues were all upset. Oh, we're going to lose him. And I said, don't worry. He's not going to go. And he didn't. And Harvard was really miffed by that anyone would have the audacity to turn down a position with him. But it wasn't until Princeton.
And did you maintain contact with him after he went to Princeton?
Oh, sure. I just saw him a year ago at a birthday party in Princeton.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, he's still alive now.
Oh, yeah. And his it was actually his wife's birthday party, and she's a little older than he is. But yes, we keep in touch.
And did he come back periodically to speak under the auspices of the Institute?
No. He came back once he was given an honorary degree here. And I think that was the only time he's come back. You know, we have a lot of people that are coming in and out all the time, but I think that was the only time he came back.
Loretta, let me just, for purpose of the record, say that you acknowledged at the beginning of the interview that all of the scholars here are so interesting that you can't choose among them. But nevertheless, I am going to ask you from the early years, certainly during Professor Claggett's tenure, besides Professor Germaine Bray, who else was particularly interesting here or excited attention on campus because of the work that he or she did?
Well, this is during Ken Sutton's time, when he invited Basil Lorethus from the Institute for Balkan Studies in Thessaloniki to come. He was the one who really turned my life around. He wanted to have a symposium commemorating the 20th anniversary of the Truman Doctrine in Greece, which is what stopped communists from taking over Greece. So he and Ken Seton marched into Fred Harrington's office, that's when he was, and wanted all this money for it. And Fred said, sounds like a good idea, and he did it. So lots of Greeks were invited, and there was such a political thunderstorm during the process of it, of the symposium, because there was a whole faction that felt the Truman Doctrine didn't do anything for Greece. And of course, there's the other side that said, look, we're not communists. At the end of the symposium, lasted about a week, there was sort of a farewell luncheon, which I say for the leftover Greeks, at the Edgewater. And we're sitting there eating, and they said, we've got to do something for Loretta for how she helped us out. And they decided, we'll give her an all-expense-paid trip to Greece next year for the Symposium on Ancient Macedonia, which they did.
How wonderful.
And that started my traveling bug. And then...
Give us a year for this, Loretta.
That would have been, I think, 66, maybe?
1966.
Or 68, maybe 68, in that period of time. And then I was also a member of the Archaeological Institute of America, the Madison Society, and one time I couldn't attend a meeting. They voted for a board, and I got voted in, and as Secretary Treasurer of the AIA. And one time I said, you know, we really should do something to keep up our membership. They won't send us lectures if we don't. I said, let's do organized tours. So, of course, I was the tour organizer.
We'll want to address tours later, because
okay.
I know that's been a significant portion of your work. Before we move on to comments about Kenneth Seton, any other observations about Professor Claggett and his role in conceiving and developing the institute that should be recorded for history?
I don't remember anything right now. That would be particularly helpful.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Kenneth Seton, who I believe was the second director of the institute. What was his background? What was he like? What special contribution did he make to the institute?
Well, he also was a very wonderful, elegant, gracious man, but he was here only for a couple of years too, you know. I know he said he had his PhD in Latin, one of them, and then into Byzantine studies, I believe. And he worked at the University of Pennsylvania Library. I think he was a librarian, but, you know, a multifaceted person, too. I remember he thought we ought to build a wing out the other side of the Washburn Observatory, and I said, you'll never get away with that. This is a historical building. Well, he tried anyway, and they said, oh, no.
he never got his Seton wing.
No, he didn't get his Seton wing.
Now, Loretta, who selected him as director?
I suspect it was Marshall's idea, and the other people. He would always consult other people, and they thought it was a good idea.
Now, is the director officially confirmed by the Dean of Letters and Science or by the President of the University?
Oh, the Dean of Letters and Science.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So Professor Seton came here from Pennsylvania
yes.
to be director?
Yes, yes.
But he only stayed for 2 years.
See, he too then was offered a permanent position at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, so then he left.
I see. Were there, during his tenure, any scholars who came, again, who were of particular interest to you?
Well, that would have been Basil DeWurthes.
Okay. And spell that. This is program on Greece and the Truman Doctrine?
Yes. Laourdas.
Okay. And if someone were interested in the archives of that seminar, Would they be here at the Institute?
Yes, yes. I can get it for you right now.
So you have printed records on every seminar given here?
Yes. And many newspaper articles from that time, because it created such a stir. And Harry Truman would have come for this, but his health wasn't very good. But General Van Fleet did come. He was the general who oversaw the army in Greece during that period.
How interesting.
Yeah.
So you really, or the Institute, had quite national prominence for that conference.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, and someone from the State Department came, too, because of this. They wanted to see what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In Washington.
So that would have been during President Johnson's tenure in 1966 or 7.
I guess so.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let me ask if there are any closing observations about Professor Seton as director here. If anything in particular changed.
No, you know, he wasn't here
long enough
to really do anything beyond that.
So then you have Professor David Cronin.
And he left only because he became Dean of the College of Letters and Science.
So he would have come in about 1968.
Did I write that in here?
Loretta, you were just mentioning about the amount of national attention that the conference on the Truman Doctrine received. And General... who was the general?
General Van Fleet.
General Van Fleet made a presentation here. Talk about the amount of attention that you and he received.
When he came, he needed some reworking of his paper. For instance, he started right off saying something about the Badger football team. And I said, you know, these Greeks don't know who the Badger football team is. Let's leave that out, for instance. But I came in for the dinner at the Park Hotel in the evening, carrying his revived speech, and I was swarmed by media there wanting an advanced copy of it. I said I only had one copy, and the advance would have to come from the general himself. We were also sent a representative from the Greek desk, State Department in Washington, wanted to see what was going on.
This is really fascinating. And as you said earlier, and I just want to reiterate this, former President Truman would have come, but for his health.
Yeah, his health was too bad. But we got a response from, well, I'm not so sure it came directly from him, but we got a response. He was in Kansas at the time.
Interesting.
So that was very nice. We weren't ignored.
Yeah, and that's good. Now we're moving into the directorship of Professor David Cronin, who must have come in about 1968.
Cronin. I've got
1969. And tell us a little bit about Professor Cronin and what his academic background was and what he did during his tenure here.
He's an American historian. He primarily was able to get our Burdick Verry Fund. It was assigned to us, and that started our having our symposia, which they usually last 3 or 4 days, and they're usually organized by one of our senior members who will be leaving our program around their area of interest. I mean, of course, we need funding for it, and the Burdick Verry does that. That's a very important part during each year to have the symposium.
Now, how did Professor Cronin locate this Burdick Verry Fund?
I think people go to the dean's office, they want to support something in the humanities, and we get earmarked for it.
Uh-huh. So this was a private donor?
Yes, yes. Burdick and Verry, the, you know, family names.
Uh-huh, okay. Did they ever visit the Institute?
Oh, I think they were long gone by the time. I think it was probably a will. I could get out some wills and show them to you, but I don't think you're interested in that. No, they didn't visit the Institute as far as I know.
So Professor Cronin used that Burdick Varia money to set up symposia.
Well, it didn't have to be set up. The money was there to use as we wanted.
Okay.
We can use it for other things if we want to, but we do use it primarily for the symposia.
And are these symposia annual?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But last year we had two. One was in French and one was Native American history with Florencia Mellon. That was a really large and successful one. We had lots of people from South America and Mexico and even Native Americans here in Wisconsin.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Now, from Professor Cronin's era, do you remember some symposia that were particularly outstanding or of national significance?
No, nothing that compared to the Greek one.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Now, Professor Cronin was director until you said he left to become dean of the College of Letters and Science.
That was until through 74, through 75, because Bob Kingdon came in 1975.
And he was director for...
Until 1987.
Uh-huh.
And it was at that time that there was a review of the Institute because they felt no one person should be directing that long, and you should have different areas. And they no longer wanted to have life members limited to 5 years to also give other people a chance to come to the Institute. I think the feeling was that within 5 years you could do a major chunk of your research and then let somebody else come on.
Did you, this was the evaluation done in 1986.
Yes.
Did you feel that evaluation was a helpful process to the Institute?
Probably it was, yeah.
And did you agree with the sense that 5 years was long enough?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Uh-huh.
It gives other professors a chance to work on their research.
So a little later I'm going to ask you to comment some more on the review, but when Professor Kingdon left in 1987, then David Lindbergh
mm-hmm.
came.
And he was the one who started our seminars. We have a luncheon every Tuesday, everybody gets together, and a seminar every other Monday afternoon. Presented, the topic is by one of our visitors here. And on the day we have the seminar, then the next day the discussion continues. And on those alternate Tuesdays, it's a new topic, a shorter topic, but there's still plenty of time for discussion, which is wonderful because it gets everyone together. And a lot of people like to present perhaps a problem they're confronted with in the course of their research, and they get help, suggestions from their colleagues here. They could be in a totally different field, but they see something different.
Now, Loretta, can anyone on campus come to these seminars?
Absolutely. We publicize them. Anyone can come.
And how do you publicize them?
Well, I used to send out invitations and then to department secretaries who email it to all of their members. We've also got a website, and I have it on there.
Uh-huh. Can you talk about, give us some examples of some seminar topics? My sense is that they're all over the place.
Well, they are.
All
they
kinds
really
of
are.
Issues.
It's whatever their field happens to be here, and it could be anything.
Uh-huh.
From the classics through the Renaissance, through French history, French literature, American history, anything.
Uh-huh. Now, as I recall the formation of the Institute, the focus was on European, American, and Asian history?
No, it was primarily classical.
Primarily classical.
And I'm not sure that was intentional.
On the seminars, Loretta, do you find that you get many non-institute people coming after you publicize
it? Oh, yes. Especially in from the department that is happens to be during that particular time. If a professor of French is going to speak, then we'll get people from the French department. And in those instances, I make sure that everybody has an invitation, a written invitation. You know, email is nice, but they read it, they zap it, and that's it. But if they have this little piece of paper mm-hmm. with it written on, they'll put it down and they... Maybe I'm just too old-fashioned.
No, I don't. I agree with you. I've lost too many email invitations.
Yes, yes.
So Professor Lindbergh, what was his background?
He's history of science as well.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Marshall Claggett called him his grandchild. David Lindbergh got his degree at the University of Indiana under Edward Grant, who got his degree with Marshall Claggett.
Oh.
And there, even though the Lindbergh and Claggett really didn't know each other except by reputation, it was an interesting tie-in
uh-huh.
that Lindbergh should end up a director here.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Really interesting. Then did he go back to the History of Science department when he left the Institute?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
They always go back to their own departments.
And then, following Professor Lindbergh, we have Paul Boyer.
Oh, yes.
Who came in about 1989, I think, 1990. So Professor Boyer actually came in 1993, and he was here for several years, wasn't he?
He first came as a senior member. And then he was appointed director. So he was here 5 years as director. And then he's supposed to have his 5 years as a visiting professor. So his stay was a little longer than what you normally say. He's got a 5 year, you know, because combined the two.
Uh-huh. During his tenure, Loretta, comment on some of the interesting programs.
Well, it was during his time that we got the Humanistic Fund, near the end of it, the Humanistic Fund, which is money that we can use almost any way we want. The dean's been very generous with us.
That was a College of Letters and Science fund?
Yes. Well, someone gave them the money and wanted to fund something in the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
So they figured the Humanities Research Institute was the obvious place for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we are still using it. The first thing it used for when with Sally Baines was then the director for a year, but she was in theater and really was out of her league here. She didn't know what it was saying. And her first thing was she brought in a guest lecturer, you know, for a couple of days, and spent $40,000 on it, which really upset everyone.
Oh my God!
You know, that's really extravagant. I mean, this wasn't a Hollywood star we're bringing in anyway. Now this year, David Sarkin has decided to use it as a sabbatical fellowship. When you get a sabbatical fellowship, they fund only 65% of it. Mm-hmm. And we would have enough money to fill in the 35% so that they would not lose part of their salary. And that's been very well received.
Oh.
So that's one of our new fellowships, the sabbatical.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a very good development.
Oh, that's wonderful, yes, yes. Instead of this one-shot spending spree.
So we had Professor Boyer and then Professor Sally Baines for 1 year.
Yeah.
And then
David Sorkin. Who's here now. He hasn't been here very long either, but he started the sabbatical fellowships, which is a very good thing.
Now, David Sorkin was a fellow here, wasn't he, before director?
Yes. He was a senior fellow. He's also a professor in the history department in Jewish studies.
Loretta, tell us a little bit about what exactly are senior fellows of the Institute.
Well, they have to go over all of it's not, if they come with the idea, oh boy, I'm free to do research, there's more attached to it than that, because they have to go over all of the applications, put in their recommendations for them, and they're expected to attend our functions here, our seminars and our luncheons, and aside from that, do their research.
Now, there are fellows from the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, and then also from the University of Wisconsin system.
That's right, that's right. And through their chancellor's office, we don't fund any of it, but it's funded through them in their home university, and there are four of them every year.
And they come for one year?
For 1 year. Usually 1 year. If they can't, you know, it's very difficult to have them replaced for teaching in their home universities, and so sometimes they will only give them one semester off. They could have it for the whole year if they wanted, but only if they can.
I see. And how long has the UW System Fellows Program been in place?
One minute here. It did in 1965 started the
System
that was actually,
Fellow?
That was only one. And apparently they had to decide whether or not it was a good idea. But we didn't start doing them regularly until 1985.
Uh-huh.
And then it was on a regular basis every year, and it still is.
Now, when those University of Wisconsin System Fellows come, do they have to present their research at the conclusion of their year?
No, but they give the seminar during the course of the year.
They
Nobody ever presents their research at the end of a year. But in the course of the year, they all give the seminar.
I see.
The Monday afternoon seminar or the Tuesday luncheon, they present their work.
Uh-huh. I know that your office is quite close to the...
Oh, I hear everything.
I was going to say, you've heard them all over the
absolutely,
years.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's quite an education.
I suspect it is. Would one say to you that... Can you pick out a favorite, or have they all been interesting? Have there been some that...
Oh, I couldn't single out one particular paper.
Have there been some topics that so surprised you as a topic that you just didn't realize that someone was doing scholarship in that area?
Well, one woman was doing something on childbirth, which really surprised me.
Uh-huh. But just an infinite variety.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I remember Mike Shanks saying to me, you know, Loretta, your PhD material, what would you go into? And I said, well, after all the years I've been so tainted, I don't know.
Interesting. Before we move on, Loretta, let me ask you if you think the Institute itself has achieved the goals it set out to do when you were first working with Professor Claggett.
Oh, I think it far surpassed what they had expected to do. I know he didn't expect we would have all of this funding to support our programs. It's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And when Germaine Braye was first offered a professorship, somebody wrote us a letter from our own campus and said, now you're not going to get her unless you offer her at least $15,000. We said, well, we've already offered her $18,000. Now you see the difference in that kind of money compared to today?
Uh-huh.
If we would have been told we're going to be given millions of dollars, we would not believe it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, interesting. Have you and Professor Claggett, since you're still in touch with him, ever had a conversation over his sense of how the Institute that he founded has done?
Oh, I think he's very proud of it. I think he is. And when Ken Seton left here to go to Princeton, he said, Marshall and I have a plan. You come and work for both of us and you get double salary in Princeton. I said, no.
Were you tempted?
Not at all. I had a family here, growing family. Pull them out of school? No way.
Okay. Interesting.
And I had worked too hard already for the two of them.
Have the goals of the Institute in your tenure here changed over the years?
I'm not sure that the goals have changed. Maybe expanded a little. In the number of people that we are able to support, it's certainly expanded. But I think the goals are the same. Give research support.
Research in the humanities.
Yes, yes, yes.
Loretta, one question for you is if you would comment on what you perceive to be the significance of the Institute to the university itself.
Well, it's true. We primarily fund people strictly in the humanities, but we also attract people in political science where their topics probably wouldn't fit in so well. But and in the law school, too, because they know that they can come here, do their research, and have the camaraderie of other research professors. So we do touch on a lot of different people, and they look to us for that very important research support.
And it's my sense from what you've said that by and large you get top flight people here.
Absolutely, absolutely. As Marshall Claggett said in the beginning, you get to associate with the greatest scholars in the world.
And that would be your judgment as to what's happened here?
Well, I'm hardly the one to judge them as scholars, but they certainly were impressive as far as I could see.
End of side one. Tape number one of the July 27th, 2005 interview with Loretta Freiling of the Institute for Research in the Humanities. Loretta, I want to ask you about the 1986 institutional review of the Institute, which I think was a very major moment in the life of the Institute, and I'd like to ask you to comment on how that review came to happen, what the significance of it was, how it modified the original goals, and how it affected future operations of the Institute.
Well, I think too many people felt we were too insulated and not open to other people, and that we should be more open to the outside campus. And first of all, our director had been here for 7 or 8 years, which they thought was excessive.
And this was Professor Kingdon.
Yes. And they didn't like the idea of the life members, and that should be limited to 5 years each to give it opens up the field, a lot of different fields that way, and each one has, it gives more people a chance to be five-year fellows here. And we opened up to the seminars and the symposia, and a lot of people could take advantage of what the Institute is offering.
Who actually commissioned the review? Was that at the request of the university president?
Or? No, I think it was at the request of the people here at the Institute. I think it was the senior members decided it was time to have the Institute reviewed. And it might have also come from the dean's office, but I'm not sure about that.
Uh-huh.
But it was...
How long a process was it? Did it take a year?
Oh, I don't think it took that long. See, the ones on the committee, Edmund Black, he was, I think, in the graduate school at the time, Bill Courtney, Donald Crawford in philosophy, Fanny Lemoine in classics, David Lindbergh, and Joseph Wiesenfarth in English. They were on the committee. So it wasn't, no one on the committee at that time was part of the Humanities Institute. This was an outside review.
I see.
So it's not as if the Institute was deciding what we should do. It was people from the outside who viewed us in a different way and thought changes should be made.
Did you agree? Did you think that some of the recommended changes were a good thing?
Sure. Yeah, I thought they were fine.
Particularly, my sense is you thought perhaps the suggestion of 5-year limits was a good thing, so more people would have a chance?
I really didn't care one way or another, but it did sound like a good idea. Now, the one thing that I have a tendency to disagree on was the facilities and services. You know, they think that we need a grand building with many offices, but the truth is, and it's getting more so all the time, people work at home on their computers. We don't need the extra rooms. And when I'm asked to assign offices in the fall each time, we say very firmly, you get an office if you promise to use it. And if they say, oh no, for instance, people who are in Van Nuys, why bother to move their stuff over here for a semester when they can work just as easily there? Come on. And then it opens up the office, especially to our people coming from the outside. Our Salmson fellows always have to have an office because this is their only place. And the systems fellows, they don't usually stay during the week, but sometimes they do, and then I can give them an office. Because they don't have an option, and I always give them Carol's in the library.
But the fellows who are faculty at UW-Madison generally work in their own offices.
It's 50-50. Some work in their own offices, and some have offices here. Frank Salomon, for instance, who is in anthropology, but he has an office here and he works here all the time. Some of them don't want to have an office here. Now, Florencia Mallon's about to leave. She's been here for 5 years, and I don't envy her having to clean out her office. Incredible!
Interesting.
David Woodward also worked up here, but then he's in geography, which was way down at the bottom of the hill. So he was here all the time, too. One of our very favorite people.
David Woodward?
Yeah, he's the one where we have the cartography fellowship. You see all of the history of cartography over there.
Yes.
That's what he was working on.
Now, when you say he was one of our favorites here.
One of mine. Everyone.
Why was that?
He's just an awfully nice fellow. Hi there. Where were we?
You were talking about Professor Woodward.
Oh, yes. He was just a terribly nice man, and he worked here all the time, and he was also the one that was responsible for our cartography fellowship, which brings a young scholar here for 2 or 3 months with a project that will help in the history of cartography volumes. That's a whole another element which is very interesting.
I know you want to talk about Professor Salmson.
Yes.
And he's notable for his scholarship and for his generosity here. Talk about him a little bit, what he did here, what his interest was, and the significance of his philanthropy here.
Well, they had been in Germany during, well, they were German, and his mother was Jewish, and in the 30s they realized they could not stay in Germany, it wasn't safe, so they left. They first were in England, then they moved to Cornell, and eventually ended up here. And when he retired, they moved to Chapel Hill.
He was a professor of
classics.
Classics.
He did a lot of work on Thucydides. I spent a lot of time with Thucydides. but we kept in close touch, too, even after he left Madison. He left Madison because he didn't like the cold winters, but he would come back for the summertime. And I would usually gone when they would come, and I'd arrange for somebody to drive them here because they couldn't. But every autumn, I would drive them back home to North Carolina.
Oh, you would?
Oh, yeah. And then during the year, about once a year, they'd have me fly down there to help him out with something. I think it was an excuse, really. And I kept in touch. And one summer, I drove them around Burgundy and Western Germany for a month.
Really?
Yeah.
So he was a child when they left Germany?
No, he was already a professor.
Oh, he was a professor?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So his mother was Jewish?
His mother was Jewish, yes.
And he felt that it wasn't safe to stay?
That's right.
So he and his wife left?
Yes, and the mother. But she ended up in Argentina. And an interesting thing, you might not like, they put all of their furniture in storage in a barn outside of Bonn. After the war, they went back, and there's the furniture still in this barn in Bonn. So it belonged to his mother, so some of it went to Argentina. Well, then she became old and frail, and she wanted to come to Madison. So she came to Madison with the furniture. And they sold their house, went to North Carolina, and left this big, decorative chest and table behind. Well, then they had an argument with the guy who bought the house and didn't want him to have the furniture. So she called her attorney and said, take that over to Loretta's house. So now I've still got this furniture, which I didn't really want. But it's an interesting trip around the world.
I'll say, really very interesting. Now, was he was a fellow here at the Institute?
He was a permanent member.
Permanent member.
Yeah, lifetime member, yeah.
And what did that mean exactly?
Well, that's the first, for instance, Germain Bray too was permanent member. They stayed until they retired. And Julius Weinberg was another one. See, our permanent members are over there, and Philip Harth. Did you notice our pictures over there?
I haven't yet.
That's what it meant. They were with us until they either resigned to go someplace else or retired.
And that was their full-time appointment here?
Yes, yes.
So that would mean, for instance, that Professor Solmson was no longer teaching?
No, they still had to teach one course, which was kind of a sore point with his wife. But he was he liked teaching, and he was a wonderful teacher. And Germain Bray, of course, said she's just absolutely idolized by her students.
Now, Professor Solmson, were you surprised with the bequest that he left here?
Not really, because they kind of hinted to me. And I knew that they were wealthy. Before we did our trip to Europe, I met them in New York, and we had dinner in the evening with their stockbroker. And I could tell from the conversation there and that they had lots of money.
Uh-huh. Now, I saw in the records that they left $3 million.
Yes, but then when they sold their house and disposed of other property, we ended up with $4
million. For a total of four?
Yeah.
Of four. Now, and what does the income from that endowment let the Institute do?
We have four Solmson fellowships. Each one gets $40,000 a year. That's a pretty good income, I think.
Now, what do the fellows have to do to earn that?
Solmson was very explicit. It had to be a research project, not for a University of Wisconsin person. It had to come from the outside, and they had to work in topics from the classics through about the Renaissance with a European focus, which does kind of limit it.
Uh-huh.
And they do their research for a year. And that was precisely the sort of thing that Marshall Claggett wanted, young scholars who have a year off to do their research.
So I assume you get applications from around the world.
Oh, absolutely.
For those.
That's another advantage. We are not restricted to U.S. citizens, and we have lots of foreign visitors. That's why I got visiting my two Russian friends this spring.
Now, who selects the Solmson Fellows?
Our selection committee. Uh-huh. We have a selection committee that does that. And one of our senior members, plus our director, is on that committee, along with the deans and the outside members.
I see. And then they come for a year.
Yes.
And do they have to present at some point during the year at one of the seminars what they're doing?
They always, and they're informed of that in their letter of offer, that they have to do that.
And do you help them get settled in Madison?
Oh, yes, especially the foreign ones. I find their housing for them. that sort of thing. Offer them bed linens and dishes.
Do they each get an office here in Washburn?
Yes, they always do. There are four little offices there, and they're perfect for them. You know, they don't come with a lot of things, obviously. And there's a camaraderie there, too, with all four of them in the same place.
Uh-huh. And do they come for the academic year?
Yes. Or they can stay longer. Our English visitor just left a couple weeks ago, so he stayed. And they're welcome to stay all summer if they want.
I see. And do some of them maintain an ongoing relationship with the Institute?
Well, they do with me. Which I guess is the Institute. You know, I correspond with them.
Uh-huh.
And then when their publications come out, they always send us copies of them. So we've got a big library full of their publications.
Loretta, one of the things I read when the Institute was created in 1959 was that there was no other comparable institution in the United States.
Except Princeton. Right.
But this was unique here because it focused on the humanities.
Yes.
Is that still the case, or have you been replicated elsewhere?
Oh, I'll bet you 50 times throughout the United States. Oh, many, many times. I've gotten so many letters from people asking how this was formed, and they needed information. And then I have a whole file on, here's what they get, the how to form an institute.
Can you tell me what some of the other schools are that have created institutes like this?
Which schools are they?
Uh-huh.
Well, I could give you a whole list of them.
Well, just mention a few.
In California, Michigan, Illinois, you know, all of large places.
All of the large state universities?
Boston, yeah. Or some of them might be funded by private funding and can simply have their own facilities without being associated with the university, though I should think that would be a little difficult.
But so that's quite interesting in that, once again, Wisconsin was a seminal
influence. Absolutely. There are so many of them now. I could give you a whole list of them.
That's interesting. Have you visited any of the other institutes?
No.
Uh-huh. Anything else about Professor and Mrs. Sompson that should be in this history? They must have dearly loved the Institute.
They did, and as Mrs. Sompson once said, that they had moved around so much in their life, they never felt very deep roots anywhere except here in Madison. They were very fond of Madison. And I kept the friendship going, and it seemed like the logical place to leave their money.
Well, we thank you. I think the university thanks you. Loretta, as you think about the Institute, has the university in general been supportive of the Institute? Have the various deans of LNS been interested in the work of the Institute? Has the graduate school been supportive? Has the Institute generally had enough money from the university?
Rather than the university generally, the College of Letters and Science has been very supportive, and the deans have been supportive, because they still fund our professorships. It's 50% with us and 50% in the teaching department, but it's still letters and science. The graduate school was also very supportive. They funded postdoctoral fellowships for years here. And the Solmson money was at the University Foundation, which then is funneled to the graduate school, and it goes through them. But now they've decided they don't want to do that, and now it's administered through letters and science, but it's still the same money.
Uh-huh.
But I think the fact that we've gotten this extra money, the Humanistic Fund, Burdick Verry, certainly shows that the letters and science does support us and must have confidence in what we can do.
Now, have you found generally that the interest among faculty in the humanities in becoming affiliated with the Institute, has that remained strong and high on campus?
Oh, I think it has, yes, yes. We have so many applicants for our fellowships, you know, for the either the senior member or for the one semester fellowships. It's very popular.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the Institute, in terms of recruitment of faculty in the humanities for the UW, is a significant factor?
No, I don't think so. There used to be one of the perks, if they really wanted somebody to come, they would get 1 year at the Institute if they would agree to come as a faculty member. And once was Bill Cronin, who is Dave Cronin's son, but Dave, this was not a family affair. Dave had nothing to do with that. But Now Bill Cronin is one of our faculty members, you know. Very, very highly respected scholar.
Uh-huh.
He's in history and environmental studies.
And is he affiliated with the Institute today?
No. Uh-huh. It was only the 1 year when he was the recruitment fellowship, they called it. But we no longer have that. I guess it's not up to us. If the Letters and Science wanted to have a recruitment fellowship, and they'd say, okay, you get this person, but we had no part in selecting the person.
Okay. Loretta, I want to switch now to, you have made several references to the amount of travel you do, you know, and the other boards you're on and the tours you lead. How does that relate to your work at the Institute?
Well, it doesn't really, except it just opens up my knowledge of the world, and I think I can be more understanding with our foreign visitors come and what they're confronted with when they come into a new environment, and especially difficult people coming with children. But you know, they adapt very easily. And I know many families, the children really were upset when they had to go back home. They liked our schools and Madison. And even my friends in Moscow said, if they couldn't live in Moscow, they'd want to live in Madison. Huh. So this is a lovely place for people to be.
And would you say that the scholars who have come here have really been quite international in scope? Have you had a lot of Europeans?
Oh, yes. And from Japan and China, Australia. In fact, we have an Australian coming in just a couple weeks, an honorary fellow. And those are the ones who need help with their housing and getting settled in.
Yes. Do you have you had scholars from Latin America and Africa as well?
Yes. South Africa, a wonderful fellow. I think that's about the only one from South Africa. And then South America less, or even Mexico. The only South Americans we had was with our symposium last spring with Native American histories, but then we had quite a number of them. We would have had more, but the State Department wouldn't let them in. The Guatemalan scholar, another scholar from, I think it was Bolivia, wouldn't let him come in. And I don't know why. What can a professor possibly do that would be so detrimental to us?
It's an interesting time in 2005.
We had to change the program because they're on the program.
One of the interesting things about the Institute, Loretta, is its location in Washburn, which has to be one of the most lovely buildings on campus. What's the story of that? I know there's talk about remodeling of it.
We're rather hoping that they forget about this. Somebody walked in the dean's office and said, I have $3 million, I want to restore an old building. And he said, how about the observatory? And he said, okay. And they had no interest in our needs. But then they brought in the university architects, and of course they came up with a figure of something like $6 or $7 million, you know, way over budget. And their plans were so terrible. Eliminating offices looking out on the sea or on the lake and turning them into a hallway, or my office, for instance, into a storage area.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to have a storage area right outside the library here? They wanted, where we have our little kitchenette, turn that into an open porch. Totally useless. In the wintertime, totally drifted, closed. But we don't know. Maybe they won't do anything. But what David Sorkin is most disturbed by, they never thought of the needs of the Institute, but rather to just looking at the drawings and saying, this looks nice.
Mm-hmm.
So we hope that maybe it won't ever happen, but I presume, I know they keep pushing it ahead all the time, or back, whatever. I probably won't be here when it happens, and I hope not, because it would be a very sad day for me.
Yes, yes, indeed. Now, do you know yet, speaking of the program of the Institute, what's the big program next year? Has that topic been selected?
Well, we have all of our fellows selected.
Tell me who they are for the upcoming year.
Loretta, I think for future generations, to give them a sense of the kind of scholarship done here, I'm going to ask you to comment for the upcoming year of 2005-2006 to give us the categories of scholars who are coming here, whether they're UW System Fellows or Thompson Fellows or UW-Madison faculty, and tell us what their various topics are, which would give us a sense of the breadth of work that's done here. So why don't we start with the University of Wisconsin-Madison resident fellows who are faculty here on campus.
We have Catherine Bowie coming from anthropology. She's working on Buddhist challenges in gender and nationalism in Thailand. And Richard Boyd from political science. Membership and belonging on the boundaries of liberal political theory. Guilhermina de Ferrari in Spanish and Portuguese. Embargoed masculinities, mapping culture and politics in post-Soviet Cuban literature. Ernesto Laverne in Italian. The Hermetic Question and the Quest for the Absolute. That's a little obscure. And Tejumola Olanyan, he's in African Language and Literature. Political Cartooning in Africa, and that's interesting. Mark Silberman in German. Entertaining East Germany, DEFA Genre Films of the 1950s.
Now, Loretta, let me ask, of these five or six who were selected, approximately how many applications were there that you had to select? The committee had to select these out
about
of?
About 40.
Oh.
And that's very difficult because all of our professors are wonderful scholars. So it's very hard. They usually, they concentrate on the project itself to see if it's a good project and how much they could accomplish in a semester, whether it's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. So it has to be probably a lengthy process and
a
difficult process.
But they all get their, I give them all the copies of the applications before the meeting so that they come prepared.
And when you apply, what's a full application? Do you have to submit?
They have their curriculum vitae and a project proposal, which is 3 or 4 pages long, and then 3 or 4 letters of recommendation. And that all comes together in their application. Well, some of them, in the senior fellowships, they have to be nominated by their department. So it's the chairman who collects the letters of recommendation. But all of the other ones who are independently applying ask for the recommendation letters, and they come directly to us, and which I just put in with their applications.
I see.
And if the deadline is coming near and there aren't any letters, I just get in touch with them and say, better prod these people to send something for you.
And the application is due when, and the decision is made when?
The applications are always due on October 15th, and the decision is usually made in early December, before the school year comes to an end.
I see. And now these faculty, this is for a year's appointment?
Yes. Okay. Well, no, the resident fellows is one semester.
Is one semester, yeah. Okay. The next category.
Then we have the sabbatical. And that just, before we can select the sabbatical, we have to find out from the dean's office who has been awarded a sabbatical. And we can pick out those that would be appropriate for the institute and ask them to submit the information. This year happens to be Serena Pondrum in English, T.S. Eliot in the Performativity of Gender. Now we go to the Solson Fellows.
Uh-huh.
It used to be, before there was, when the graduate school was funding these, they had reduced theirs to one fellowship, and there was no restriction on topic. We would get 100 applications, and you're supposed to pick out one? So now, with the restriction of the period, we don't get that many, but about 25 or so. That's uh-huh. still quite a few.
Yes.
So this year, we
please review those for me.
Anthony Corbeil in Classics at Kansas, University of Kansas, Boundaries of Sex and Gender in Ancient Rome. Geraldine Hang, English, University of Texas, The Invention of Race in the Middle Ages. Michael Kulikowski, History at the University of Tennessee. The Rhetoric of Being Roman, 4th Century Politics and the Fall of the Western Empire. Dale Van Clay, History, Ohio State University, From Catholic Reform to Anti-Catholic Revolution. And they will be here for the academic year.
Now, the foresight, both of Professor Claggett and Professor Solson, in bringing these scholars from outside of Madison is really quite significant, I think, for the university.
Yes.
Because I'm assuming that the Solson Fellows do interact with relevant faculty from the university.
Oh, absolutely.
Here.
And their teaching department invites them to all of their events. You know, here we've got classics, English, history. I will inform them that these people are here, and they're told of all the activities in that department.
So that's really, that's quite a gift to the intellectual climate here at the university, to have these outstanding young scholars coming here.
Yes, it is.
Oh, that's great. And next category.
Well, it's the Siskins Fellows. And strangely enough, all four of ours are from UW-Milwaukee this year. Normally, they come from a variety of places. Now, we have the first one, Margot Anderson, History and Urban Studies. Hers is Official Statistics, Confidentiality and Privacy, the Effective Use of Government Data in a Democratic Society. Then we have Sukayana Banerjee in English, Imperial Citizens, Colonial Subjects, Professing Nation, Narrating Empire. Hmm. Then Ying Wang in Art History, White Gold, Salt Culture in Ancient China, Lisa Samuels in English, Modernism is Not Enough.
Now, Loretta, I know that the Institute has receptions at different times.
Yeah.
I suppose there are opportunities when the senior fellows, the system fellows, the Solson fellows all get together.
Well, that's every seminar.
Every seminar,
every luncheon. And there's lunch here every day of the week where you can get together.
Mm-hmm.
That's more informal. It's, you know, strictly brown bread lunches. But there can be a whole table full of people just discussing any amount of things, any number.
And the conversation must be rich.
Oh, yes. I remember one time, that was when Ken Sutton was here, they were trying to discuss which case you use in Latin when you're saying on the rocks.
Must have been a drinking day. I don't know what the decision was.
Interesting. Any other categories here?
Yeah, we have the William Coleman Dissertation Fellowship, which is the first time. Now, William Coleman was a professor here, too. He died too young of leukemia, and his wife set up the Coleman Fund.
And he was a professor of?
He was in history of science, too.
Oh?
And he was here for, he was a senior member here for quite a number of years. And then when he died, his wife set up a fund for the institute, and we have been having the Coleman lecture, memorial lecture, and Mrs. Coleman's been very generous in adding to this fund, and it got so big that we suggested to her, it was David Sorkin decided, why don't we try having a dissertation fellowship Coleman? We could do one semester every year, and she liked the idea. So this year, it's Paul Erickson in History of Science, The Politics of Game Theory, Mathematics, Rationality, and Cold War Culture.
Huh, how interesting.
The same thing now with the Madeleine Dorn Fellowship, where David Sorkin said we should pool our money with English so that we would have enough so that we can offer a fellowship, because graduate students really do appreciate this. So we have Hillary Tainer, and she's working on the outside of the inside, Servants, Wards, and Family Structures in 18th Century Drama and Fiction. Reminds me of the old PBS, Upstairs, Downstairs.
Downstairs, yes.
Okay, then we have the Honorary Fellow. We have an Honorary Fellow coming from the University of Melbourne, David C. Goodman, and he's working on the grassroots debate about U.S. entry into World War II. That's interesting. And also Jim Stokes, who's been here before. He's from UW Stevens Point. Records of Early English Drama.
Loretta, so, just listening to you recite that for just 1 year, I think of the, it must be 46 years of existence of the Institute.
Yeah, yeah.
The conversation that has gone on in the halls here is really beyond one's comprehension.
Yeah, yeah. It would be nice if it all could have been recorded, or at least the highlights of it.
Yes, yeah. And that's lost to the ages now,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Except for what you can tell us, since you heard, you have heard all of
I
those.
I hear this. I sit there and I listen to their, and it's such a wonderful education. In fact, I can't. I would find a professorship in one field rather boring, whereas mine is wonderful because you move from all sorts. Of course, I'm not in depth in any of them, but it's very interesting nevertheless.
Are you ever invited in, or do you ever choose to pull up a chair?
Oh, I could always do that. But, you know, if the phone rings, if people come in, I'm there. I can hear perfectly fine out there.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't create a disturbance.
Uh-huh.
I'm quite happy with that.
For being in an administrative role, I would think that you have, for someone like yourself who has these significant intellectual interests, this would have to be the perfect job.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, there are plenty of women around who are waiting for me to leave.
Well, I hope you're not leaving.
Well,
you're still enjoying what you're doing.
Oh, very much so, which is why I am here. But you know what I liked about this? I'm looking for the review of the Institute. Did you read the review of the Institute?
I did read the review of the Institute.
Well, I rather like that last paragraph here.
Yeah, I liked it too. I'm going to read that as we conclude this interview. This is with reference to the 1986 review of the Institute, when the review committee was making a total of 12 recommendations. The 12th recommendation concerned Loretta Freiling. The outstanding contributions of the Institute's secretary, Loretta Freiling, cannot go without mention. Almost without exception, Institute visitors and fellows remarked on how important
Her efforts were to making their stay pleasant and productive. She is experienced, well-trained, efficient, and helpful in ways that go far beyond the job description for her position and are not commensurate with the salary she currently receives. In fact, she functions as the assistant to the director, and a person in such a position is essential to the success of the Institute. Today is July 28, 2005. This is the second interview with Loretta Freiling, a member of the administrative team of the Institute for Research in the Humanities. There are several other subjects that need to be covered. And Loretta, I'm wondering if you could comment on the creation and establishment of the Institute's library.
Since this is a research institute, obviously a library is very important, and we were quite a ways from the Memorial Library. And the dean very kindly gave us about $1,000 a year for quite a number of years to establish our library. And now we have a fairly good library. And
which dean was this?
That was Dean Ingram.
Ingram.
And even now, people from Van Hise, for instance, since we're close by, call and see if they can come over and use the library, which of course they can. So it's useful to more people than simply the Institute fellows.
Now, what kind of books were you looking for the library?
Well, since we were heavily into classics in the beginning, our library is primarily classical through the Renaissance and a lot of encyclopedias from a variety of languages. And you see there's the Encyclopedia of Islam there.
Uh-huh.
And in a number of languages, covers all sorts of topics. For instance, the French will give a different slant to something than our encyclopedia will.
Now, would you buy books for the library as requested by your various fellows?
Yes, yes. And we can do that today. Not on the grand scale we did in the beginning, because obviously we have a pretty well-established library. But we do invite suggestions from our fellows and purchase books. Usually we're pretty able to accommodate their needs, now with the Humanistic Fund, which gives us a little more leverage in that.
Is the library at the Institute part of the UW-Madison Memorial Library system?
No, it's our library. We are cross-referenced in a way, so that not completely, but they can have people come up. And Madeline Dorn gave us her library.
Oh.
And Robert Reynolds his. So we were given other books that we did not have to purchase.
And to this day, you have money to continue to acquire.
Yes, but we don't need as much now.
Uh-huh.
Because we have pretty much what people need.
Uh-huh. Oh, interesting. Loretta, we were talking before the interview about one of the giants of the Institute, Professor Germaine Bray, and you were telling a very interesting story about her life and World War II that I think would be interesting to have recorded for the history of the Institute.
I was reminded of this story because of the conversation at lunch today. David Lowenstein was talking about his Jewish family and how they coped with the Nazis during the Nazi period. I was reminded of Germaine Bray telling me a story about her mother who was living in France during the Nazi occupation. They knocked on the door of her house and said she'd have to leave because they needed the quarters. She said, "This is my home, get out." And they left.
That's amazing.
And Germaine was teaching here at Bryn Mawr, and when the war broke out, she decided as a loyal Frenchman she could not see her countrymen without her help. She went back to France, volunteered in the ambulance corps, and drove ambulance through North Africa and apparently in France as well. And after the war, de Gaulle decorated her with the Legion of Honor.
Really?
Quite a remarkable lady.
Quite. She was truly a giant of the Institute, was she not?
Absolutely, absolutely. She was so charming and open to her students. She was so approachable. They really felt she was one of them.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
That's true also with Madeleine Doran. Madeleine Doran almost had a maternal instinct with her students. They loved her too, and she supported them completely.
Uh-huh.
That was her whole life, for in Germaine's as well.
Interesting. Really a deep commitment to the students.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I could also say the same about Marshall Claggett. When he had his graduate students meet for their advanced seminars, he would take them at home in the evening, and they would meet there, and his wife would serve them refreshments, and it was a very close-knit group. It wasn't the cold classroom sort of arrangement.
Now, did some of these extraordinary people continue their ties to the students once they were here at the Institute?
I'm not quite sure what...
Would they invite some of their former students to events here at the Institute?
Well, of course. We had Erwin Hebert and David Lindbergh, who was one of our directors at one time. Of course, he wasn't a student of Marshall's. But yes, the students do come for our seminars.
Uh-huh.
They're current students. If they're graduated and gone away, that's a different. But the ones that are on campus here, yes, they're invited and they come.
Just again, it attests to the value of the Institute for the purpose of the university.
Yes.
Now, Loretta, one other area that we wanted to cover was one section of fellowships that we did not talk about yesterday.
In addition to our...
Hello!
We wanted to have you comment on the Dana Allen dissertation fellowships.
The Dana Allen is in addition to the Doran and the Coleman. But Dana Allen, we give for a full academic year every other year, and it's open to any topic. Whereas Coleman is history of science, Doran is English, but this is open to any field.
I see. And how many are there?
Only one a year.
Just
one? Of the Dana Allen. We only have the money for one, and that's only one every other year.
Uh-huh. This concludes the entire interview with Loretta, July 28th, 2005. Thank you, Loretta.